Accession number 10231, reel number 2.
Sir Ronald Swin, reel 2.
We did that for long enough to turn the groups of soldiers into really efficient teams, knowing exactly what each man had to do and working together like a team. And then we went on down to Falmouth and joined the ship, I can't remember the name of it suddenly, Princess Beatrix was it, or it's one of those carrying ships, which was anchored in Falmouth, and we were shut up there. We weren't allowed to go ashore. We then were assembled, I think it was the first evening, by Colonel Newman, who outlined the purpose and the planning for the raid and gave us a rough idea of our tasks and about 40 pages of orders. I went off to the lavatory to meet, as the only really quiet place in the ship, to read my orders. I'm terribly forgetful, and there was a furious knocking on the door after about 10 minutes, and I hurried up and left to find the colonel outside, and went back to my cabin. To my horror, I found that I left the orders in the lavatory. I got the biggest ticking off I ever had in my life. But we then read through the orders. We had conferences with Colonel Newman, and then we went off with our individual groups of soldiers. It was very well planned. We had all the information we needed. We had a model of Saint-Nazaire, which was gave us an absolutely clear idea of what we had to do, where our target was, how to get there, where the enemy might be, what support we were getting from our little support groups. I didn't have all my 12 soldiers trained in demolition under me. Four of them were sergeants, and they were allocated to Stuart Chant. They were very good men, and they gave him very good service. I had 8 in the end, and I was to blow up the southern lock on the new entrance. That big, long new entrance was the main entrance into the port. I think there were 2 locks there we had to blow up and a swing bridge. And I had 8 men and a detachment under John Vandeverve, an officer in number 2 command there, with 4 soldiers armed with Tommy guns to protect us while we did this. There was a sort of area there. There were 3 lock gates. There was Bradley, who was to blow up the top end of the lock gates, the gates at the top end of the lock. Somebody called Walton, Philip Walton, who was to blow up the middle one, and then there was the pumping station. I can't remember who was to blow up there. So I was part of a sort of area under Captain Hodgson and Captain Pritchard. We really knew exactly what we'd got to do by the time we left. It was very well planned indeed. The whole thing was beautifully planned. Equipment was good. We had exactly very well thought out loads of explosive to carry, and the arming was very good. We had Tommy guns and Remington Colts. Trouble is, Remington Colts are wonderful weapons, but you do need to learn how to use it. And my demolition soldiers were armed with this beautiful weapon, but they really didn't know how to use it. And I got leave to go up, take a boat up the river, up the Fal. It was a lovely spring day, and I had a wonderful day bowling turnips down the hill for them to shoot at, and throwing them in the air. We had a great day shooting. I think we went out 2 days. My sergeant, Tom Durant, was a very good shot. Actually, I'm boasting, but he and I were the best shots in the command there. We could beat them all at rifle shooting. But he was a very good shot with a pistol, too. We had great fun competing with each other. But how they would have got on when it came to the point, I don't know, but they never had to. You could actually kill somebody at 50 or 100 yards range with Remington. Not 100 yards, perhaps, but certainly at 50, if you knew how to shoot with it. So we It went on like that for a few days until we'd all been properly, we'd learned our job. I suppose, in fact, we were waiting for signal to proceed from Combined Operations Headquarters. And there, I imagine, were waiting for favorable conditions. But the main determinant of the timing of the raid was the tide, because we couldn't get up the Loire through the channel that we wanted, except at high spring tides. And I think we went up on the actual peak of the spring tides in the end. It worked out very well. That, again, was extremely well planned. So we set sail, not for Saint-Nazaire, but for Spain, right down through the Bay of Biscay. Lovely weather. And as you'll know from the rest of the history, we ran into trawlers which were sunk by the destroyers. We were a submarine sweep, and with the destroyers and the MLs. I don't think we were seen. One always felt there might be a German aeroplane in the clouds looking at us. One had a sort of feeling of some hidden eye watching us, either from a periscope or through the clouds. But I don't think they knew we were there until right at the end. On the second day, we went quite far down south of the Loire entrance, and came back again on a sort of northeast course to make the rendezvous with the submarine, which was the beacon, which we had to contact, the column had to contact. And from that point, we were on our own, and the destroyers remained behind, and we navigated behind Campbelltown up the estuary and up the river. And that all worked absolutely perfectly. There was a navigator called Lieutenant Green he was a specialist navigator who got us to the submarine, and my ML passed actually just beside it, just as close as that, and had a cheery voice, and then we were on our way up the river. As you know, we went up the northern channel in the Loire, which was well away from the coastal batteries on the southern shore. Nothing happened at all until we were quite close in when the shooting started. We were ML number 14 in the column, which was very near the end. We were one of the last MLs. We were one of the last MLs in the column. So we saw it all sort of developing in front of us. Not that you could see anything, obviously, at night, but you could see the tracer, and it was very, very wonderful firework display. We came up. There was a light ship which we all had pasted with the Bren guns, and as we went by, it was rather pointless. And we gradually came up to level with the old Merle. And that, by that time, was a terrible sight, because not only had the air raid been called off, so that the anti-aircraft guns were could be used to shoot up the MLs coming in, but the on the old Merle was a sort of emplacement, and the German soldiers in there were. Found it very easy to bomb and shoot up the MLs as they came into the old Merle. And there were a lot of burning MLs when we arrived. And we cruised around for quite a time. Ian Henderson, who was the captain of my ML, decided he couldn't go in. I think quite rightly. I don't think he could get into the old Merle. I agreed with him on that. I did think, though, that he ought to have tried to go in higher up. And he was very different to do this. He thought he said he didn't know the lie of the shore there. I thought the place to go in would have been perhaps north of the, or rather east of the Normandy Basin. And he said he had no idea how the shore lay there, and we'd probably just go aground and get shot up. What he could have done, actually, was to have gone into the old entrance. But you could hardly blame him, because the fire was very intense indeed. They were burning MLs everywhere. And so eventually he turned the ship round, and we left for home. Went for home with a lot of grumbling from my soldiers. They felt they'd come all the way there. We'd been busily engaged in shooting up the searchlights and so on. I used a brain gun till it was red hot and changed the barrel and took all the skin off the inside of my hand. It was a frightfully inefficient thing to do, because in our regular instruction to the soldiers, we always taught them not to handle the barrels when changing them, except by the special handle. But I lost the skin on one hand, but it was very good target shooting, and I think we did a certain amount of damage. But it was very sad, and Ian Henderson decided to turn for home, and so home we went, towards home. I don't quite know how long it was. I ought to have looked it up, because it's the Germans gave the times in one of their books. But it was, I suppose, about half an hour later or more. I was cutting up sandwiches in the below for the soldiers, and the number one of the boat, Philip Dark, came along and told me to come on the bridge and to keep dead quiet and to shut up the soldiers. And I did this, and Henderson just handed me the night glasses, and there were the outlines of three destroyers. And I was munching a sandwich, and it turned to dust in my mouth. It was a very funny feeling, that, because I didn't actually feel fear. It was purely physical reaction. I was frightened, but it didn't come into my brain, so to speak. It was very strange. And I had to spit all the sandwich out, but I then went down and brought the soldiers up quietly, and they all took up positions on the ML, which came right up to us and shined a searchlight on us and told us to surrender. And we didn't, and replied with fire, and it was rather hopeless, really, because they were very much higher than us. And however, we gave it a few bursts of the Erlikon and the Bren guns and the Tommy guns, and then it shot us up pretty badly.
Can you describe how?
Really, it's rather confused in my mind. It went very early on. Ian Henderson was hit in the head badly, and his number one was knocked down. He was hit in the arm and leg, I think, but not terribly badly. But it gave him a sort of shock, and he seemed to disappear for a moment. I think he was probably unconscious, I don't know. The other naval officer was hit quite badly, and a lot of the soldiers on deck were killed or wounded. And then the destroyer went off a little bit, I went down below to see what was happening down below, and I saw holes appearing in the sides of the ship simultaneously. You know, there's a hole there and a hole there. One or two of my soldiers were dead down below. And then I went on deck again, and the destroyer came in. It can't have gone away very far. It came in again. It tried to ram us, or it did ram us, gave us a glancing blow. That may have been before it drew off. May have been before Ian Henderson was hit. Because anyhow, we took a share across, and it didn't actually do an awful lot of damage to the ML. And it was still shooting at us. And Tom Durant, all this time, had been on the Twin Lewis. Nobody understood Lewis guns in the Second World War. But of course, the regular secretaries were trained in them in the 1930s. And he knew all about Lewis guns, and he was rather glad, I think, to get on this Twin Lewis. And he'd been shooting away at the destroyer, regardless of anything that was shouted at him by the Germans. And I started parleying with them, and I think it was at that point that Durant gave the Germans another burst at the bridge. And they really let him have it, but he went on shooting until he absolutely dropped on the floor, terribly badly wounded. However, I parted with him, there was no point in going on, and I surrendered the ship. And that was all there was to it. I don't know how long it took, really. It seemed an awful long time at the time. I think, in fact, it was a much shorter time. I've talked to Fritz Powell, the captain of the destroyer, who became a personal friend. And he says it was much quicker than I estimated. And I think probably he would be right, because I dare say somebody was logging it on the bridge. We managed to shoot up the bridge a bit. His light was put out, and somebody was wounded there. He wouldn't tell me at the time how many casualties he'd had, but there were certainly quite a few of the crew of the destroyer were wounded or killed, because there was blood about when we went on board. However, eventually they surrendered. By this time, it was daylight. It seemed to come daylight very quickly. We got everybody off, the dead and wounded, and the Germans took them off. And I only had a few splinters in me. I was very lucky.
Whereabouts?
In my legs. I'd had a few splinters in the legs. It was absolutely nothing. I mean, it was just like having been through a thorn bush and picked up some thorns. You know, it was no worse than that. But most of the, a lot of the sailors and soldiers on board were either killed or wounded. And they took us on board, and then they were absolutely wonderful. The Germans really looked after the wounded beautifully. And I was Philip Dark, the number one, who'd been a medical student for a bit. He was awfully good. He buckled too, and he and I were helping bind up people, and they ran out of bandages, and they ripped up some of their linen to bind people up. We had one chap with a foot shot, or lost a foot. I think he'd been overboard, and he'd been picked out of the sea, and I think he'd been hit by the screw of the destroyer. We're never quite sure about that. Durant was enormously badly wounded. He was wounded all over. And I nursed him for some time. Then we gave him some morphine. And I kept on getting requests from the captain of the ship to go and see him. And I was very irritated. I said, sort of F off, you know. And eventually the number one came along. Previously he'd been a sailor. And said to me in very good French — I speak French, I didn't speak more than all the sort of limited German — and said to me in very good French that the captain really did want to have a word with me. And I said, I'm not going to be questioned by the captain. And he said, no, he wants to give a glass of brandy. And I said, well, that's different. When I finish what I'm doing, I'll come along. I went along and I had a long chat with him. He was very nice. And he later came to the prisoner of war camp, which I was in, to inquire how we were getting on, because we were at Spangenberg, and he had some relations down there. He had leave. And he later, after the war, became a friend, and I went to stay with him. My company, which I was chairman, shipping company, ordered two extremely expensive ships costing 40 million apiece from a shipyard in Germany, of which the managing director was his number one. Wasn't it extraordinary? He wasn't on board the destroyer that night. He was ashore, a man called Dr. Huxemeyer. And he invited Fritz Powell up when I was launching the ship, when my ship was being launched, one of them. And he took me off down to his house in near Kassel, quite near where I'd been a prisoner. I gave him lunch in the castle where I'd been a prisoner. He was a very nice man. He'd been over to London, and rather cosmopolitan German. He'd been a merchant captain before the war.
How did your treatment by the Germans continue once you got ashore? Was it still...
Well, it wasn't the same thing at all. It was charming on the ship. On the ship, I went back to the wounded, and then Captain Powell came down to see me, and just as he was talking to me, we'd come into port, actually, I think, at that point. I think the ship must have been tied up, otherwise he wouldn't have been below. But there was tremendous excitement, and bells rang and so on, and an enormous explosion had taken place. And this was the Campbelltown going up. And we went running up together on deck to see what had happened. And the Campbelltown was coming down as we arrived on deck, and pieces were banging around all over the place. And it was very exciting. And, of course, we knew we'd succeeded then. And then eventually they got us all off the ship. And it was all done with great courtesy and kindness. And when we were going over the side onto the shore, Captain Powell drew the whole ship's company up to attention, saluted us. And I didn't know what to say to thank him. And I'd concealed my fighting knife on my person. I thought it might come in handy for picking locks or something. And I decided the only thing I could do to thank him, he'd been so kind, was to hand him my fighting knife after all, which I did. And he grinned. And I think he said, "You ought to have given that up," or something. And he kept it for me all the war. And after the war, the Americans made him break it. Because the Germans weren't allowed weapons of that kind. And then when we made the documentary, he brought the fighting knife with him and he presented it to me in its broken condition. It was really rather kind of him. He was a very nice man. But as soon as we got on shore, it was very different. And they were just rough, that's all. They didn't actually stick bandits into anybody or anything like that. They were unsympathetic and rather pushed us around, but they were quite decent to the wounded, I think. I didn't see any brutality to the wounded. They rather sort of used their rifle butts. We didn't hurry, that sort of thing. And they put us into lorries, and we drove through Saint-Nazaire early in the morning and joined up with our friends at La Beaule.
Can you tell me what kind of feelings one would have before a commando raid? Whether it was one of excitement or apprehension or what?
Oh, frightful apprehension. Anyhow, in my case. I mean, I found that on the three raids I was on, all of which were a little bit uncertain, you know. I mean, it was doing something which the Army and Navy weren't really accustomed to. They didn't know really what was going to happen. And particularly the Saint-Nazaire raid, which I think few of us thought we'd get back by sea. I certainly didn't think so. I was relying on the fact that I could speak French fluently to get through the town and get to open country and walk home. But I don't think an insurance company would have been very interested in us. And I found that frightful apprehension. But in a funny way, I think it was a good thing because one had sort of lived it all through before. And when it came to the actual affair, it wasn't nearly as bad as what one had imagined. And so one wasn't too worried. And I know quite a few of my friends who were in action in the war found this, that they got so steamed up. I know Derek Mills Roberts, who's a very sort of imaginative Celt, partly Irish, partly Welsh. He said it was the anticipation was far worse than the actual thing, so that when it came to it, it wasn't too bad. And I found the same. I honestly don't think I was frightfully worried at the time, but my God, I was shit scared before. Imagine the most ghastly things, injuries and so on, you know. But then I was so busy with telling the soldiers what to do and doing things for oneself that it was really rather exciting in a way. I think quite a few people found that.
You've mentioned that particular book about Latouche, which you criticise for its inaccuracies.
Yes.
Has anything else been written or said which comes to your mind which needs correction?
Well, he also wrote about the Channel Island raid, and he got most of that wrong. He incidentally wrote about the independent companies in Norway. He got names wrong. He got an awful lot wrong there. I've got the book somewhere, and I could easily let you have my corrections if you wanted it. But you're not really interested in that. You're interested in voices, aren't you?
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. I could, if you were doing a piece on it, I could easily tip off somebody who was involved in it to put it right. Mickey Byrne was in Norway. He could put you right about Norway.